And up next on the stream of free radio at freakradio.org, it is your Sunday Bathrob Spears Broadsides show. This Sunday, however, it's going to be a relatively long interview with Katzenjammer Keith McHenry. The name Katzenjammer is taken from the comic strip The Katzenjammer Kids, which you probably would have read if you were, I don't know, 103 years old. But it was about some sort of devilish young boys who harassed a character called the Captain. And I've always seen Keith as a kind of an impish fellow, though, with a very serious impact of a very positive kind. Anyway, Keith is going to be the current part of the show, and then there's going to be a lengthy flashback, which goes back to June 24th, 2007, a long one, and I'll be describing it in more detail if you can get through Keith's interview, which lasts about 45 minutes. And it's you can also find a description of this flashback probably online now at the Huff website, though it hasn't been described before. I had to kind of dig it out of the archives, listen to it, and make some notes so I could pass on to you exactly pretty much what you're going to be hearing, and I will be doing that. There's a lot of interesting stuff. There's a James Ross memorial, Michael Rhodes talking about the Kincaid case, Tenderfoot Tim Rumford is joint host, Jon Golder, a sort of a expert on vehicular law, Osha Newman, a Berkeley Police Review Commissioner, and more. And I'm going to be going through that in some detail after you hear the Keith McHenry interview, or after that one is played. So listen in, hang on, and enjoy, and also maybe, who knows, maybe learn something you didn't know before.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
With Keith McHenry, it's September 25th, around 4 o'clock. And Keith, you just got out of a Zoom meeting that kind of covered Food Now Bombs International, because Food Now Bombs has independent chapters throughout the world doling out food to the anyone who wants it. Can you imagine that? Anything come out of this meeting that you want to comment on?
Well, it was very interesting, because there were different kind of backgrounds of people who started their chapters, so therefore having different ideas but it was really cool. So the facilitator had actually come out like of a communist youth background, which is her language was interesting, and she admitted, you know, like we called Food Now Bombs a club, and there was like a hierarchical thing, and then the people like in
what country was she from?
And that, from Edmonton, Canada. Mm-hmm. And so that was cool. It was like a new group that was both, I guess, half anarchist, half, you know, Marxist-Leninist, apparently.
They actually get along?
Huh?
They get along?
Yeah. This has become more and more the case over time.
That's good.
And then, Yeah, this kind of, because of how psycho everything is, it's like at this point no one gives a crap really much about their labels anymore. I mean, so, to a certain extent. I mean, I'm sure that'll return over time.
Mm-hmm.
People aren't quite so desperate. But, and then, let's see, then we had, the 19th anniversary of one of the chapters in the Philippines will be happening in October, so there was, that was exciting. We talked most, there was, like, how to get more volunteers. So the Turin, Italy group wanted to know, it was kind of funny, they wanted to get more volunteers, and they have only between 7 and 14, which for many chapters is actually about what you usually have. So that was really interesting. We also had a discussion a bit on, in answering that, one of the things I spoke on was to just, like, recruit the people that are eating with you to be your group. And, you know, as we've had, you know, I think we're getting close to 50% of the volunteers live outside. Probably a little more housed than unhoused, but it's getting to be, you know, a huge percentage of people that are in the in main roles of doing put-up bombs live.
Well, As I told you, when we spoke earlier, I tuned into the very end of this Zoom meeting. I saw that by the time I got there, there were about, I guess, 8 to 12 people left in the meeting. I was just wondering, are people who are living outside, do they have capability? What's their computer-like capability? Because you can't really Zoom without a computer, right?
Well, some people can. I mean, I could have Justin, for example, has a whole hookup where he can go online and everything. He's our guy online at San Lorenzo, and he's online all day, basically.
Hmm.
So that kind of thing can happen. And then also we had people from the parking lot. Well, it was Laura that zoomed in, but we've had people zoom in from the parking lot to Zoom meetings.
You mean the Laurel and Front Street?
Yeah, Laurel and Front Street. So we actually, people were really pleased that Laura went around and had different people talk to us, including our volunteers who were actually serving the food, and then people living outside, and newcomers and old-timers, you know, and that was in the middle of the meeting. That was really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And people really loved that, too. It was really cool. Like, and then let's see what... so that is a possibility. In our case, you know, and I think that, and people were real excited about the idea. Some people, you know, they wanted to know how you can help unhoused people in your group, and I just, like, just walk up to them, ask them to help. And then also that and people could tell that we've made long friendships with people. And it's a matter of, like, for instance, Edmonton Food Up Boss, young people that are doing it, just so over time will eventually become friends with the people eating. And just as long as, just be open to the fact that people coming to eat are just as adequately capable of being volunteers as those that have houses.
How many people would you say who are currently servers and cooks at Food Not Bombs here in Santa Cruz live outside?
Well, Ryan, for instance, is a regular. You've got, a whole bunch of people that are outside, are randomly in and out, serving food that live outside.
Mm-hmm.
That's very common. It's a really cool mixture of, like, retired people, unhoused people, college students, people that have work off their hours for community service. It's quite a batch of people.
Hmm.
And then we have unhoused people that are sometimes do the clothing with us.
By which you mean the clothing kiosks,
and the clothes and everything.
That's donated clothing donations, that are given out. Okay.
One of our top cooks is but he had to leave town for a while, but, a sea otter. But so, you know, there'd be like, you know, probably, well, then we have people that do the compost or one of the main people coordinating that is unhoused. There's, there's all these different roles that people play. There's also people that live outside to help me load and unload my vehicles.
In previous conversations, we've talked about how one of the problems with the broader homeless movement, the Union of the Homeless, for instance, is the fact that it seems to be it weighs so heavily on a few individuals. Whereas I've noticed at Food Not Bombs, even when you became ill a couple weeks ago, people sort of stepped up, or at least that was the impression I got talking to Laura and so forth. Is that something that you found more difficult in days ahead, becoming easier because there's more of a sense of solidarity, staying about the same?
I think it will increase with the union over time. But it's, and I think that things have gotten a little better, could potentially get better with the union, but there have been a lot of rough.
Well, I was talking about Food Not Bombs.
With Food Not Bombs, I think that will not be a problem at all, you know. Yeah, no, people, now that, I mean, I'm impressed with the students coming back. And even though we're diluted in our a number of referrals from Community Options because now other places have opened, whereas during much of the pandemic, we were the only volunteer opportunity, so we were getting everybody. But you know, and then we're now getting, like, a lot of students and in the local Santa Cruz Food Not Bombs. And, so I think that... some people have to step back too from Food Not Bombs because they are going back to college, things like that. You know? So it's a back and forth kind of thing. It's real pretty interesting.
Have other food services closed during COVID reopened?
No, none of the indoor ones have that I'm aware of. Hmm. Everything is still the same. You know, Meals on Wheels going to meet people at different locations outside.
St. Francis Soup Kitchen.
Bag lunches. A lot of the food stopped to different hotels and things like that. So a lot that happens. So we have the hotel eviction thing is like really totally psycho. It's like, you know, people are given different, you know, they're given one date and then something happens and eventually they get another date. So right now there seems to be eviction scheduled for October 15th, but we heard that was, that the September 15th was the end of some of the hotels, possibly because they didn't really get any place for anybody to go, very few, although my friend Earl did get a place over in Watsonville, so that was really positive, but there's still, I think Nikki got a place and she can't stand it and wants to leave, but I'm not completely clear if that was that she just is still at the same hotel or if she an actual new apartment.
Now, one of the issues that I spoke with Sophie about, who was at the union meeting last night, which I wasn't able to attend, and I guess for folks who are interested, the union, the homeless, is still meeting every Friday. Are you still going to be meeting at 5 o'clock, or is the cold and the dark going to drive you to an earlier hour?
Well, right now it's still 5 o'clock, but it may move. It's kind of, for me, tough. Tough to get even at 5 because of all the, you know, that's a day that we get our big shipments of food from Second Harvest and stuff like that. And so I, like, really am super busy all afternoon moving food around mm-hmm. to the different places where it's supposed to go.
And for those who don't know, which probably doesn't include many, too many people listening, this is a meeting that happens in the Benchlands, kind of right above the Benchlands, between the county building and the Benchlands, at the tables that are right outside the doorways where you exit the county building to head toward the Benchlands, if you're familiar with
where
that.
Where the jury meets. The
jury sequesters itself, yeah.
Yeah. So that's 5 o'clock right now every Friday. And,
well, one of the issues that
had some discussion on the October 4th.
That's what I was going to ask you about. That describe again. I mean, I've said this. This is a flyer that you were able to. You saw a copy of that actually describes vegetation maintenance is going to require complete vacating all areas near the levee. Between the beach and Highway 1, which is quite a stretch of turf, by October 4th. But then again, when I talk to Jeremy Leonard at the Huff meeting, whom I know you regard as a dubious source, and I have no idea. I think he regards himself as a dubious source because he isn't getting a lot of information. He claims that it's only going to be a very, very narrow vegetation cleanup that isn't going to affect the benchlands unless it's sprawling actually down into the river. So he's trying to fence it off, he says, so that there is, essentially so they're left untouched, and the people who are being impacted, who are not in the benchlands, are being, supposedly given space in the benchlands. Now, when I talked to you about this briefly, you expressed some skepticism about this. Have you gotten other information, Keith, you think we might, benefit from?
Yeah, so anyway, at the meal, definitely one couple came up specifically upset that the cops had told them they had to move by Monday, and they asked the cops where they're supposed to go, and they said, well, we really don't know. Hmm. Just have to leave.
Did they say where they were living? Were they, what part?
I don't know where on the levee they live, but there's a lot of people. Although they kind of ebb and flow all along. For instance, we have a lot more people living at Lot 27 now than ever before, but it's being maintained really well. It's pretty cool, then it goes along the up to the top. There's people living towards the river, past like the, but they kind of come and go too. But I think the cops move them out randomly from like over by the Kaiser Stadium, and then you keep going down. There's like been people living all along, not the riverside. There was a weird. I wonder if they just got kicked out recently. I'm not totally, but there's usually people, there have been for months now, people living all along the Front Street side of the levee, all the way down that patch. And then there were some people living kind of in an area where the bike path goes under the, I guess you might call it the Broadway Bridge or the Laurel mm-hmm. Bridge. And then the same thing on the other side. There were people all between the skate park going up to the bridge, and then all along the other side, mostly towards the away from the river. But then you get to some areas where, like, at the Soquel Bridge, that community under the Soquel Bridge has gotten huge in the last couple of weeks. It's potentially, I don't have any. I haven't counted all the tents and stuff, but it seems to be almost double what it was even like a month ago. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's going to be affected. And then you've got all the people. So then you go all along. There were dotted like tents all the way. There was a couple of tents right by Soquel and the levee on the behind. Near Front Street there, there's several tents parked along there, and then there was more tents further down, and tents all the way down to the footbridge, randomly, mostly, though, away from the river.
Now, have any of these folks, other than this couple, come to you and either said cops have come and told them they're going to have to move by October 4th, or they've seen posted signs in their area?
That's the only people that talked to me directly about that. So far.
What's your estimate of it then? I mean, based upon that sample and based upon your sense that there are a lot of other people living there who haven't come to you, who presumably, some of whom regularly use Food Not Bombs, I imagine.
Yeah, just not everybody, I'm sure people were told and they came to eat and they never told me, because they might not, never occurred to them. And I don't know. I would say that it's no less than 20 tents that would be removed, maybe more. And if they're going to be removed, it's and with no plan of where to go. But and then I think that. So I'm wondering if that whole area that's below, across from the Rental 40 Creek, it goes under the bridge, which is a huge camp, is going to be cleared. I don't know if they
That's the one that's right. That's right beyond Brent's camp. You're talking about the fenced off
one. Yeah. That goes like like right behind Good Times. That camp there is getting big.
And I think that was one. That was one Jeremy specifically referred to. I think suggesting that he had offered to put up in camp, you know, give tents to the people or help them move into the Benchlands area. And although I haven't talked to anybody at the Soquel, you know, the Brant's Forte Creek area. So have you spoken to anybody there recently? Or?
No, I haven't. And I can't imagine. That would really increase the size of the Benchlands camp by a lot. That would be, you know, that's like 30 tents alone right there. So I don't know. I mean, that's pretty impressive. And then, like I say, then maybe 20 or so on the other side of the river. Maybe even more. So then I would say this maintenance thing is another what they call a red herring, because when they kicked us out of Lot 27 for the maintenance of the levee, right, and never put a single piece of equipment in the Lot 27, and then when you watch them do the work that they, which is good to do, they were cutting willows and stuff down below with two you know, like a tractor pulling, you know, giant lawnmower type things. And those two tractors they just got, you know, they just locked them up and left each night, and they went back to work. So they didn't need to put them in the, you know, in a parking lot. And this is why they never did. And then the other thing is that there are very few people living that close to the river in those kinds of areas. So I you know, the reality is that's they could just send those people up to the top of the levee, and that they're, you know, maintaining the levee would be maintained. And it might be three camps that would have to move up out of there rather than...
On another subject, Keith, any reports on RV living and whether harassment has increased, decreased? I'm noticing there's a show where Steve Plaich is interviewing the Association of Faith Communities, which has a so-called program to, you know, give RVs space to be. And, of course, RVs and actually so-called oversized vehicles are a subject for the latest target of the Santa Cruz Shitty Council, as I like to call them, and coming up again probably the second meeting in October. Any thoughts on any of that? Any new reports on how things are going with those folks?
Well, they're still being ticketed, and people are being towed in their vehicles, but I don't know a lot. I haven't seen a lot of that recently. Like, usually we do get people coming to the meal that just lost the vehicle, but there's not been any real drama recently since that Operation West Side Story. Just the regular, normal ticketing. I did talk to a friend of mine who was just really angry about living in Santa Cruz, and he, he told me the other day about how he, they took his vehicle and all of his family photos and everything, and all of his tools and all that, and it got junked, and he couldn't get anything, and he lost everything that he had. You know, down to zero again, and then you have to start over. So, that, you do get those stories, and I got that story 2 days ago. His vehicle, though, was towed, probably 8 months ago, so it's not, a news story.
I know there were a couple of news stories when Anthony Prince was visiting, along with Robert Aguirre. I was able to, refer two people, to Anthony and to Alicia, and you were kind of busy trying to organize things so that there could be an actual musical event that, happened.
Next one is on Halloween, and it'll be Johnny and the Spooks.
We're
all excited about that.
Everybody dress up as pumpkins, that sort of thing?
Yeah, things like that.
What I'm saying is, I know there were reports then of RVs being taken. I know that there was some talk, I understand, at the union meeting, at least this is what Sophie told me, of the ACLU seeking to get accounts through either through Alicia or through Sophie of people in their RVs who are facing or are actually experiencing this kind of eviction with no place to go. Have you heard anything about that? Any sound that the ACLU is actually intending to do more than jabber or refer the matter to the Northern California ACLU or whatever?
I don't know any details about that, but there is like a, you know, generally speaking, the Alicia's done like really great research on the Washington State case that was recently won. And so the idea is that some combination of attorneys and with mainly actually Alicia and kind of me cheering her on and bouncing ideas off her. But she's, so to collect declarations of people about, you know, losing their RVs and getting excessive tickets, that's a lot of what we're trying to find out is the actual, what kind of tickets have been, you know, so but then, you know, the violation of the Eighth Amendment is, you know, the intent, the ticketing of these vehicles, so they're financially out of reach for the owner of the vehicle is a violation of the Eighth Amendment. That's the basic thing.
Well, I know I have heard of three cases recently. Pirate got his vehicle not ticketed, but threatened with a ticket, and he was, he's the kind of guy who gets kind of cranky about feeling that if he's being told he hasn't got any rights when he knows he does, it ticks him off, as I think it properly should.
Yeah, I like that attitude, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's me too. We tried to track down some of, they were citing him on five different citation claims, but the primary one had to do with A, the right of municipal authorities to make up their 72-hour law statewide refers to abandoned vehicles. It does not refer to stored vehicles, although I think they give the city authorization, although I'm not entirely sure of this, and I'm hoping that we can get somebody who's a more legally skilled and has more motivation to look into this than I to get some information for us over here at Huff.
And while we're waiting for all that information, let's hear a little old-time music.
About Minnie the Moocher. She was a low-down hoochie-coocher. She was the roughest, toughest frail. Minnie had a heart as big as a whale. Heidi, 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 ho!
Heidi, 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 ho!
Horses. Each meal she ate was a dozen courses. Had $1 million worth of nickels and dimes. She sat around and counted them all a million times. Hadi, 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 hadi,
hadi, hadi, hadi, hadi, hadi, hadi,
hadi, hadi, hadi, hadi, hadi, hadi,
hadi,
Poor man.
You win.
Having lost her daughter to a murder, domestic murder situation, is not the happiest person and is not spending a lot of time with us these days. But it's still of interest, obviously, to anybody who lives in their vehicle. And then that's often part of the so-called capital H homeless population, you know, here in Santa Cruz
and
elsewhere.
Yeah, and then, so that's why Alicia's had to move into her vehicle with her family. So she's really got a lot of motivation because she's been harassed. Like, you know, they did all the street signs, the limit parking there where she'd been for like a, you know,
on Olive Street. Yeah, I remember
Olive Street.
And
yeah,
even though the community moved into support her, and you know, she was able to get the Public Works Commission to support her as well, didn't do any good with the Myers, Matthews majority. I guess Matthews wasn't on the council. Maybe there was, but
yeah, she was at that time. She's gone now, but
yeah, I mean, it's the Myers majority. It's really what they've got. Of course, they've had that for quite a while. Even when Don Lane was the mayor, they had. It was only briefly.
Yeah, it's never been. Yeah, it's been anti-homeless.
Well,
like,
you know, when Glover and Crone were there was a glimmer of hope, but you know, that one went by the bottom. Yeah. Well, you've been pretty much organizing independently of this. Your general perspective, as I understand it, is the city does what it wants to do, and we do what we think we need to do, and we don't spend our time asking for permission or permits or anything of the kind. We just do what
Correct.
We... Go ahead.
Yeah, and I think we're... Yeah, that's my basic thing, and I think this is... you know, proving to a certain extent to be true, is that the people in governments, they don't actually help anybody except for other rich people that they work for. And therefore, poor people have to just make their own trip themselves, which is really what people have been doing. And now it's just getting slightly more consolidated and more organized in some way around Food Up Bombs doing meals. And this is the case all across the country. That's actually kind of the case in many parts of the world. And you know, just like in the Philippines, there's like a massive amount of anarchist organizing that's even beyond Food Up Bombs. So I think Chris said there were 6,000 basically free grocery stores in the Philippines that are mutual aid grocery stores that are just free groceries set up on streets. And very colorful signs and all this stuff, kind of the, you know, like kind of the jitney gone free food style. And then, that's the thing, is it looks like that basically there's going to be this, the outsiders, you know, that just are not only actually technically outside and homeless, but just the people that are not welcome in the mainstream society, and then there'll be the people that are clutching on to the, you know, hope of being included in the in crowd, and the, you know, with their housing and everything, and then, so those two communities of people will kind of ebb and flow as to their, you know, the amount of people that are dropped out of society.
Keith, any reports from inside the jail? I know Santa Cruz Union member and a Food Now Bombs volunteer, Randolph Tully III, a.k.a. Dread Eye, was being held in jail, may still be held in jail for, terrorist threats or something of that effort?
Yeah, you've got a combination of cases pending, and he is still in jail, and I went and spent the morning in court on Friday, and he was not happy when he came out, and he, you know, to get his charges and whatever. And I do, which I sadly, I will have to call TJ on Monday and find out who the attorney is. I forgot to get his name. But he's actually been connected, working of his cases, and he's been trying to, I think he enrolled him in an anger management program that was really not, that he kind of, according to the attorney, had, he didn't really qualify for, but because he's just so, trying to solve the problem of Jedi's outburst that he, he actually, they did a mental, a psychiatric evaluation to find out what's going wrong with the, because it's a physical problem in his brain from injury. And so they're trying to solve that. And, but it's a drag. He's been in jail for a while. And I've got to try to get the keys to his car so we can move it more. I towed it away from where it was.
Is there any way people can communicate with him by mail in jail? I think as I remember from years ago, you needed to actually get signed up on a list to even receive, to even be able to send in letters.
Yeah, I don't know that, a lot of stuff has gotten messed up because of COVID, but somebody should try, I'm going to try to put money on those books, but you have to do it by computer now rather than show up. I said you can't just be able to go and put money in his books. I may do that. I may try that tomorrow or Monday.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe tomorrow, even though it's Sunday. I don't know. Maybe it might be a better time to go in. But Cooper was telling me that she's been trying to put money on people's books.
Now, Cooper's, of course, a long-standing person who's been driven from pillar to post, but always seems to come up with an optimistic attitude, sometimes ridiculously optimistic in my view, but nonetheless a lot of strong spirit with that person. Is she still living in the Food Not Bombs lot? Last I heard, she kind of said she moved around from night to night, from one spot on the concrete to another.
Yeah, well, things are really mellowed out at the lot as far as living. And she does have a mansion now.
I see.
A lot. So that's pretty cool. And they've got a really nice tent, double wide, basically. And I guess a couple people there. But some of the people that were very destructive have been whisked away. Particularly the last name. She left huge piles of problems there, and she was having very difficult time, and she's no longer there, it doesn't seem like.
This isn't Cooper you're talking about. You're talking about somebody who was a problem person there? Or?
Yeah, she was kind of a mess. She had a lot of stuff thrown all around, and we were spending a lot of energy cleaning up the area. We periodically have that. There's been, there's ups and flows of that. We had one woman that was made beautiful, actually, art. But also a lot of garbage, and then within a lot of garbage. She moved up onto the levee, we moved her up there, and she's up there. And she's an interesting person. She did no way at least.
And I think your phone's beginning to fade, or you possibly are swooning. I'm not sure which.
My phone might be dying. And then, we helped another person out. We got a tent for the family. This one family came in from Nevada. They had been living here, and they lost their place early in COVID because where they're running, they needed to, a relative needed to take the space, and they ended up out. And so then they tried moving to other places in the country, but the moms said that it was just horrible everywhere. There was just no, they knew more people here, so they came back. And so they're living in the parking lot, and they got, so right when they came in, somebody donated a canopy with walls. So they got their little tent and the little beautiful two-person tent. So all four of them were in the little two-person tent. And trying to hang in there up against the wall. Now they moved over behind the Sweetheart Bonds meal. And then, there's like quite a crew there, plus a lot of people living in vehicles.
Any indication that there's going to be a change of ownership in the Santa Cruz Community Credit Union? I know there was some controversy. Some members of the union, including Michael Posner and others, were struggling to circulate a petition to stop the board of directors from selling the property and essentially slating it for demolition along with the rest of the downtown gentrification effort.
Yeah, well, it's a really interesting thing. I should do a video of this, maybe even use my iPhone, because it's fascinating to see this, all this construction on one side of the street, which is what's displacing so many people. They're building luxury condos, and then now it looks like that whole, the board of directors decided to go screw you, community, and it's just going to locate to 41st Ave. And sell the land to this New York developer that's building this luxury hotel with a hotel, swimming pool on the roof, apparently, according to their drawings. And this looks like a real scumbag company that's moving in, could move in, but there's no real information as to where that's going or anything like that. And then that other big project where India Joe's and all that is, who knows where that's at. But India Joe's, I think he's going to just go to catering starting the first of the year, just like to screw that. And then, so there's that. It's going to be an interesting winter as things kind of, who knows what's going to go on. But with a housing moratorium being over, eviction, housing foreclosure crisis happening, it seems like a lot of chaos is on the horizon. Here's what I read, that there was like nearly 100,000 more restaurants probably will go under this winter. But the newest restaurants that are happening are basically either large transnational corporations trying out new types of menus, the ones I'm seeing in downtown Santa Cruz, or just people that have a crap load of money and that's a hobby. That seems to be like what's replacing the many, many other restaurants and food establishments that are going under in the country.
But Food Not Bombs will continue.
We will continue, and we're looking for a piece of land privately owned where the, we've got, it's already sketchy what we're doing right now as far as losing shipping containers, although we might get another one just to plop it next to the one we got, because we're trying to stockpile as much resources as possible in the situation where we try to get an entire another shipping container full of dry goods like beans and rice and stuff, just in case there's a huge disruption. And
I should say you also are posting pretty regular reports on the Facebook page of Santa Cruz Food Not Bombs. Most recently, I think you go through the benchlands and you take, there's a lot of photos you've done of there's actually a sort of a free food pantry that's been set up in the benchlands.
Yeah, well, there's a kitchen with John Paul and Russell and them at what they call the Marine Corps kitchen, because it's got the Marine Corps flag. And then there's Judy's, Mama Judy's Memorial Pantry, which we deliver food to. And then we've got the Santa Cruz Homeless Union, outreach center where we provide lots of water. And
there's for private enterprise folks, people selling coffee for a dollar and things like that.
And tomorrow I've got to go get a bunch of supplies for them. And we got the money for gas to keep the generator. They guard everybody's phones that are being recharged and stuff. So they've got that going. And then, of course, next door to that is a corral with goats and chickens that Kevin is operating.
Now, the infamous goat farm, yes.
Yeah, so it's an amazing thing. It's going to be interesting to double that, you know, basically, between now and the memorial service for the people that have passed on the streets on December 21st. I would it could be like as many as double the amount of people living in the benchlands at that point. I don't know how they're going to do that. And then it seems like they're reducing possible locations for people to be. So the whole thing is psychotic. And which gives me the impression that, you know, it's happening all over the country, all over the, you know, even in Canada, mass will be and stuff.
Any reports from other cities like Chico, Novato, Pacifica, where there have been either injunctions or legal attempts to hold off this riptide, this right-wing reactionary riptide?
No, the only thing I've been following most is I've been following the Kalamazoo, Michigan sweeps a lot, and a bit on the Portland sweeps. I mean, that's still happening regularly. They actually have hired Portland has a private company that does the sweeps with the that's their whole. It's been privatized, and so there's a lot of resistance to this company for doing that.
Are Portland activists still doing protests as they were last summer in any way, or has it pretty much died down?
It seems like the daily Black Lives Matter protests and at the federal building have kind of petered out at this point. I never hear anything about that. Mostly what I hear is just actions surrounding, like in neighborhoods where different, you know, where black people are killed, you know, that typically is where it seems like the protests have been. And then anti-homeless sweeps, and then there's combinations of. So, the other thing that there's a lot of energy is in the there's a business district rezoning thing, luxury thing over in Washington D.C., luxury condo construction and sweeps of homeless people there. And so there's been a lot of resistance to that. And then a person, I don't know if the person was homeless, but the Metropolitan Police shot death, a black man just sleeping in his car, and that sparked some bit of rebellion there. It was interesting that it cost over $200,000, I believe it was, to get rid of 60 people out of a park in Toronto recently, but it came to light that it cost over $200,000 in police time. So there's that's happening, and this struggle it's very interesting that there's a lot of struggle in D.C. and Trudeau Bombs has been real involved in it, and the like today they're doing a picnic in Franklin Franklin Square Park in front of the which is where Trudeau Bombs has served for a couple of last few years, and the Washington Post office. Headquarters right across the street from it, and they then cleared all the homeless out, kicked out Food on Bonds to renovate the park, and then they've created all these new laws and rules, and Food on Bonds is back there today in defiance of that, although we're also doing our regular meal wherever they moved to, which I don't know where they might have moved back to McPherson or something. I forget what they did to to keep serving food. Meeting, it was interesting too because of the lockdowns are very severe in other countries, and so they really struggle. Malaysia really struggles. That lockdown is very absolute. Australia is very absolute, and Canada is intense.
Have
a hard time getting out with their food. It's kind of like a it's really crazy.
Has Food Not Bombs been involved in any of the anti-vax or anti-mask protests or anti-mandate protests been happening in different European countries?
No, I didn't. No one referred. Well, we only had a Newcastle. Australia. We only have one person from Europe, and then the and I don't know what the I don't know any there was no reference to, and I don't see specific connection between Proudhon bombs and the anti-mandate, so
the protests,
these types of protests that are going on, anti-surveillance clampdown, whatever kind of nightmarish things. Although the Aaron from I think she's from Newcastle, Food Not Bombs. She talked about how she felt like right wingers had infiltrated the trade union, the construction workers' protests in Melbourne or ruining it. But I don't, you know, that's also what the mainstream media in Australia is saying. So I'm not, you know, then I'm getting left wing activists sending, you know, tweets about it, and it just seems like it's just basically, you know, a lot of people of color in a large way, particularly Lebanese, is what one person's reporting, who are the people that actually have to lay the bricks and do the, you know, that are out there, who have been told they can't work for 2 weeks, and they're marginal people, so they need to have money, and it's not being provided, and that's why they're on the streets, and they're claiming they're violent, but I would say they're, you know, other than throwing rocks at the union headquarters for, you know, collaborating with the government.
Gotcha.
And very successful highway blockades and stuff like that. But
I'm going to be looking for more accounts of this. But I think I don't know. I've reached my saturation limit. But
yeah, me too. I should probably go do something. I've been on between the Zoom meeting for 2 hours and dealing with all the logistical issues all morning downtown, and then now doing the 5-hour radio program with Robert Norris. I've had it.
Well, you've only done 45 minutes of the 5 hours.
Oh, but okay, that's all that was.
We'll have to play some of your past shows to fill in the time.
Yeah, we'll get one of my 88 shows from 1988.
We have some of those, actually. Yeah.
I know you do.
Indeed.
And so you can reach us at foodonbombs.net, and we need people every damn day, noon to 4 at Laurel and Front Street.
Thank you, Keith, and
okay, have fun out there.
You too.
Bye bye.
A state Supreme Court ruling will have a major impact on how every city in Washington really deals with cars and RVs that people are living in. Q13's Brandy Cruz joins us live this morning. You know, Brandy, this actually goes back to a 2016 case that we have covered here involving a man and his truck in Seattle. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning to you. This man, Stephen Long, is someone who we interviewed a couple years ago when this happened. He'd been homeless in Seattle since 2014. He did handiwork, construction work, and he comes back from work one day and realizes that the truck that he had been living in had been towed. And then he found out that if he didn't pay a fine that was almost $1,000, that the tow company would be able to auction his truck off. And he said, wait, first of all, I can't afford that fine. And also, my truck is considered my home. And so there was a lawsuit, made it all the way to the state Supreme Court. And now we are getting a verdict from the state Supreme Court that really, as you said, Liz, is going to have some profound impacts on the thousands of people in our region that either live in an RV or in a vehicle. The state Supreme Court basically saying that under the Homestead Act, someone's vehicle can indeed be their home. I want to read from the state Supreme Court ruling for you. In part, it read, homestead exemptions are based on the notion that citizens should have a home where family is sheltered and living beyond the reach of financial misfortune and the demands of certain classes of creditors. Seattle City Attorney Pete Holmes responded to this statement, saying what we reiterating, you know, what we said there about the impact of this, saying this decision will have wide-reaching implications for how mayors and city councils from every Washington city respond to people living in their vehicles on public property. And so there's obviously, you know, huge implications of the ruling, but there's some things it doesn't do as well. For instance, it doesn't mean that if you're living in your RV or your car, you can just park anywhere without consequence. The state Supreme Court said it is allowable to ticket vehicles that are parked improperly. They just said that those tickets can't be excessive, and then you can't auction off someone's home, in this instance, a car or an RV. Now, one of the problems that cities will run into then, Liz, is, you know, let's say you ticket a vehicle 100 times. You know, there really isn't any additional enforcement you can take. If somebody decides, well, I'm not going to pay those tickets, if you can't, you know, a tow company is not going to come tow it and just let it sit there unless they can eventually auction it off. And if they can't do that, there's really no purpose in towing it. So it definitely limits what cities can do.
They say, saying it'll bring jobs here with much better pay. We really need jobs here, and we need them bad. They sent overseas all the jobs that we had. We apply for these projects, even ones that we hate. Some crew out of Texas steps out of the gate. They tear through our mountains, they tear through our town. And after the damage, they're nowhere around. We love our mountains, on earth. No one knows better what mountains are worth. A heart from the mountains is a heart that is blessed. We love our mountains, we know them best. It's a war on the mountain, a war on our ways, for a handful of profits in a handful of days. Sometimes it's a gas line, and sometimes it's crude. The rich, they get richer, and we just get. We know how they see us, and it's no surprise. We look so small in the company's eyes. We look like nothing that matters to them. One more little town they can deal a week. Love our mountains, the finest on earth. No one knows better what mountains are worth. A heart from the mountains is a heart that is blessed. We love our mountains, we know them. Building a pipeline through the mountains, they say. Though the floods have no pattern and the goldfinches stay, the winter comes hard after too early fall. The almanac these days is no help at all. They say that the pipeline will help out our town. Won't be any leaks or spills on the ground. They're calling it progress, and we understand. again. They're calling it progress all over again. We love our mountains, the finest on earth. No one knows better.
And that was Carol Denny singing This Year Earlier, posted on June 11th on, YouTube. We Love Our Mountains as part of her San Francisco Free Folk Festival. Looks like an online folk festival. Just look for Carol Denny, D-E-N-N-E-Y, and you can find some of her songs online. And that concludes the brief, but... contemporary part of this show. Coming up next, it's a flashback to June 24th, 2007, as I mentioned earlier. We're going to be looking or listening to the James Ross Memorial. He was an older guy who joined us in fighting to preserve the rights of public space on Pacific Avenue and the rights of poor people to be able to sleep at night and the right of people, whatever their income, to be treated like human beings. Against the kind of creeping forces of gentrification. Then we're going to be listening to Mike Rhodes from Fresno and some of his associates who sued the city of Fresno when they stole their property and destroyed it. And that was the Kincaid case. Pam Kincaid successfully sued with, I think, six or seven other plaintiffs and for 10 years held... to some extent, Fresno police, sheriffs, and wrecking crews at bay, and allowed for the establishment of encampments under freeways that were somewhat self-protective communities, which were actually assisted not by the city, but by private individuals who supplied porta-potties and trash pickups, something that I urged people to do here in Santa Cruz, but didn't happen really until recently in when the COVID crisis struck, and then the city kind of had to do something. Then you're going to be hearing co-host Tenderfoot Tim Rumford, who served a lot of food, who was also an online presence writing about homeless struggles and civil rights. He had a website, I think it was called Homeless for Humanity. Humanity for Homeless, I think it was, .com. I don't know if it's still available, but I wish it were. He also wrote some articles for Santa Cruz Indie Media, which you can find around the struggles of people to just be left alone, to be themselves, even if middle-class merchants and prejudiced residents didn't want to see them around. Then we're going to hear a little bit from Yon Golder, who was a vehicular expert in a way. He had been homeless, and he had been living in his vehicle with his dog, BW, and he'd also been dealing with cops trying to displace him and his pooch, and he was giving advice on how to deal with parks and rec rangers like John Wallace, who was a very... with a bland smile on his face, stealing people's property back in 2007. You'll also hear Osha Newman, who is a police review commissioner who he reviewed the police department and tried to keep them in check, although they, even in Berkeley, which had a relatively strong police review commission, it was weak. And he talks about life in Berkeley. There's more, too. Tim Rumford talks about, kind of does an expose on Pleasant Care nursing home abuses. We have street interviews with Gregarious Greg, who was a street singer and really an inspiration to the whole group of street singers who sang every Wednesday night under the auspices of a group called SAFE, Society for Artistic Freedom and Expression, challenging the anti-homeless and anti-musician, really, downtown ordinances by severely restricting space and time in order to essentially discourage street performers while claiming to regulate them. And we also have the situation where some of us were, with the help of attorneys David Beauvais and Kate Wells, seeking to file a lawsuit on behalf of people being victimized by the sleeping ban sections of the camping ordinance. In order to do that, we needed to get court records, and the court was holding back on them, so we had to go and videotape us demanding the records. And so when the sheriffs came, they became too embarrassed to arrest us, and eventually we got some of the records, though the lawsuit was never successfully filed and carried through. Who knows? That may change in the future as future groups struggle to do the same thing. So here it is, June 24th, 2007. Check it out.